Unanimous. Well, just like the anima derives from the mother, the animus from the father. He can be on the negative side. Now, again, remember we're talking law of averages here. Convictions which are unshakable and which don't really hold up to reality. Like my friend saying, we'll never translate with computers. You can see that was the animus speaking, but that's classical animus. That's the negative side. The positive side is inspiration. Creative inspiration. And just like the man has to work in transforming lust to meaning, the challenge of the animus is transforming, I would say, rigidity into inspiration, creativity. But remember, we're talking here on the average, and that any variation is possible. She says something which kind of sums up what I've been skirting around. The difference between the anima and animus on 135, go down 2, 4, 6, 8 lines. Whereas the anima usually appears in the form of a fascination, an allurement that draws the man into life, the animus often appears as a spirit of death.
Like
the beard or... Yeah. And by death, I think it could be physical death, but just cold, abstract, relationless living. I was talking to a woman recently about her experience of being beautiful, and she said, you know, beauty is power. I get what I want by my beauty. But power is cold. So my beauty has made me constantly struggle with coldness. That's the animus. That power and control. Where I mean, typically the anima obliterates the man. The animus focuses the woman, but it's a negative focus. And again, she's contrasting. And if you remember, take it with a grain of salt, I think it's worth looking at. About halfway down, a little bit more than halfway down that paragraph. Oh, no, I'll pick up where I left off. Indeed, there are even some fairy tales, see where I am, in which a woman marries a handsome unknown stranger who is revealed later on as death personified, a revelation that brings about the death of the woman herself. Now, back to the difference between the two. This is tied to the fact that as a projection-making factor, a man's anima produces mainly passive, that is, empathetic projections, that bind the man to objects. I think that's the distinguishing factor. Anima binds the man to objects. The animus, on the other hand, produces more active, that is, more judgmental projections that tend to cut the woman off from the world of objects.
Objects is
one more thing. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm stuck on this.
And Marilyn Monroe.
People, too.
Objectifying.
Yeah, I would say cars are an anima projection, personally.
Cars and boats are.
Cars and boats.
Female.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are a substitute for the female.
And yet those objects are cold, so it leaves the man cold as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I worked with a guy once who lived in Speedway near the racetrack, and he dreamt that there was a huge Gothic cathedral built underneath the racetrack. That's a substitute for religion. Absolutely.
And, yeah, which is why it makes sports fans to be rabid, and actually, you know, you can have mobs and people can kill each other
yeah.
at a sporting event.
Yeah.
You know, like it's the same religious fervor, you know, mm-hmm. that produces war.
Mm-hmm.
And the religious people have realized that because the street preachers are at all of those big sporting events.
Oh, they are?
Yeah.
Are they?
Oh. Saying, you need to come back to God and spend Sunday in church.
Cross the goal line with Jesus.
Let Jesus be your coach. Yeah.
Let Jesus be your coach.
And so you have the sports people who can't see that they have that substitute passion and the religious people, and they're both adopted.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting, we were downtown one time going to IRT and thinking on the street corner, it was a big football weekend, and so football people were milling on him. And this guy was actually talking about God and, you know, the last day is coming, judgment and all that things. And he had an audience. It was kind of interesting.
Sure.
Yeah, well, watch baseball. How often these guys cross themselves before they go up to bat?
Well, and there's a guy who's Tim Tebow.
What did he do? I don't know.
Football player.
Oh. Last year in the Super Bowl, he and his mother were on a TV commercial because it was suggested, she was very ill when she was pregnant with him, and it was suggested that he be aborted, and the family decided not to and prayed through it, and he was born. Mm-hmm. So they're very big in the Right to Life movement, and so he got known then for his religiousness, and now he has been the underdog who's coming up through the playoffs, and they beat the Steelers last weekend when they thought they were not going to be. Nobody gave them a chance.
God is on his side.
He didn't say that, did he? Everybody's saying it. It'd be kind of he has enough understanding of not pushing the situation too far to not say it himself, but he allows everybody else to say it. So it's
okay. Wow. Okay. You got that, I think. Now we move into another story.
First of all, yeah, go ahead. I just want to get clear. She's talking about the negative aspects of the animus here, that he moves the woman away from reality, away from the world of objects, through her judgment.
Yeah.
And is that, in her positive aspect, he focuses her? Or is it...
I'd say inspires her. But I think they generally both start out negative. Maybe it's changing. I don't know. Healthier parents, it might be changing. I don't know. But
sometimes with healthier parents, you're picking up all the I see my brothers and I see that they are much better fathers than my dad was, but yet I wonder about their kids. And like my one brother, he and his wife for years, I watched parenting videos like every Friday night. That was what they did, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, just overboard with trying to be good parents. And I wonder what effect that's going to have later on with the kids, that perfectionism.
There's a new study that came out that has shown that the things you do with your kids doesn't really have much effect. It's all who you are.
In our language with the book, I'd say it's what you are unconsciously projecting onto them. That's the limit of conscious behavioral techniques of parenting. the kid will turn out the way you unconsciously see them.
And like my one brother, the other brother, his daughter, they're really working with her on, when she was in the second grade, she came home burst into tears because she couldn't do everything right, and it wasn't right. So that perfectionism that they don't mean to be placing on her, certainly is.
They are placing on her. Anything else so far? We launch into a story of Perpetua, a 22-year-old Roman woman condemned to death for her Christian beliefs. And now we're into the story, so I'll be throwing out some names for you. She has dream visions in which a fellow martyr, Saturnus and Pomponius. Now, the reason I went into review of the old Mass, we can think of these as personal, as the personal animus corresponding to Charity and Apuleius. And she has a figure of a white-clad divine shepherd and a helpful fencing master. So where she's trying to give us a way to kind of compare the anima and the animus, where Lucius had Isis and Charity, she's got the shepherd and fencing master and Saturnus and Pomponius. Isis would be the parallel to the shepherd, and Charity the parallel to Saturnus and Pomponius, meaning that the anima, you might say, or the animus, is the inner pattern, and these more human figures, Saturnus, Pomponius, Charity, are how that is lived out, or images of how that is felt in individual personal experience. One's the form, you might say, and the other is the way that form is experienced. And she's given cheese as the fruit of immortality. You don't like cheese? Oh. Switzerland made me a convert to cheese. And then a green bough of golden apples. I don't know if that's all that important. But then with these experiences, she is able to go to her death. An interesting detail, this third line on 136, to her, the two dream figures were appearances of Christ in disguised form, but the dream visions themselves do not say that. So here's a little bit of Jungian methodology. These daimons, or better, this daimon, for the two are identical, that is the shepherd and the fencing, is rather an archetypal figure that was constellated at that time in the collective unconscious of the whole world, including the non-Christian, a spirit of religious renewal whose special mark of distinction was to appear directly to the single individual as a spirit who showed the way. So that's how I think Jung would understand religion in general, that it's a particular cultural image of a more general universal trend that is activated simply because it's activated within the individual. Or you could say that the animus came to her in this form of a collective image. And what is so important, these figures are guides. But notice, rather than leading her into Eros, they're leading her into death. Which, we'll see in a minute, L'Enfance takes as the particular cultural manifestation of this experience, but as also somewhat typical of the animus, that the negative animus will lead the woman out of life. On the right side, these personal animi would represent her ability to commit, where the personal anima for Lucius would represent the personal ability to respond with feeling and devotion. So very close, but slight emphasis. Well, they're awful close.
One's been able to act and they even have that feeling.
Well, so it's a little more of an idea.
It's an idea,
a conviction as a goal or an ideal, as opposed to a passion, I suppose.
Yeah, one would be an ideal, the other would be a passion. But an ideal will lead you into passion,
yes.
And passion presupposes an ideal. Mm-hmm. So that's why I've said don't make these distinctions too black and white, because they have different sides of the same thing. I mean, she's willing to die peacefully because of what she believes in, and as such made an impact on the early history of Christianity. This figure of the shepherd she just mentions on 137 has a a role apart from Christianity in early classical literature. I think that's probably enough to say on that. The shepherd of men, Poimandres, I think it's pronounced. There's some pre-Christian texts in which the author has been approached by a shepherd and guided. And that's one of the reasons Jung took the position he did, that the shepherd bit, that's not just Christian. That's a universal archetype. And all Christianity did was pick up one manifestation of it and frame it into a figure of Christ.
The Buddhists have like levels of consciousness, and that's the highest.
The
like,
shepherd? Is it?
They said that like the king governs everybody equally, but the shepherd puts the flock above his own personal self. Mm-hmm. So the shepherd sacrifices himself for the good of the flock, so that's the highest level of consciousness. And I don't know who the Buddhist teacher is, I just don't know about it, but they have that same image,
yeah.
And they don't associate it with Christ.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Everything all is new.
She quotes Philo of Alexandria, an early writer, who calls the shepherd the true logos, just another word, for that inner voice which can guide us to meaningful living. Remember the story of the small, quiet voice?
Yeah.
That's an example. Well, those of you who know it, bear with me. This actually happened. It floored me. When I was taking one of my French classes, I got to know one of the students. And no psychological knowledge. She was about 18 or 19 at the time. And she looked kind of upset. And I said, well, what's going on? And she said, well, here's my story. My dad's a steel worker in northern Indiana. He makes decent wage, and I've got a couple of siblings. And my parents said to me that they could pay for my education at a state school. that if I wanted to go to a private school, I'd have to make up the difference, which, you know, as you can imagine, is considerable. And I asked my small, quiet voice what I should do. And my small, quiet voice said, educational advocacy. Let's see, the shortness tells you it's genuine. And she said, by that I understand that what I am to do is, I don't want to teach, I don't want to be an administrator, but something like lobbying, or working in a foundation of lobbying that deals with educational legislation. And there is no school around that offers a degree in educational advocacy. But Butler, I discovered, would let me create my own major. So here I am at Butler, and I'm having to take out all these loans to pay for my education. And I don't know how I'm going to do it. But I've always listened to my small, quiet voice, and so that's why I'm here. See, that's exactly the shepherd. So she got a job at Chili's, I think. She came into class smelling like tacos one day, quesadilla the next, and you know, she was beat. I could just tell it was wearing her down. But then, on top of it all, she came down with, or I don't know how you say it, started, became diabetic. Mm-hmm. You would know this, but one day to the next. She was fine, next day she was diabetic. So she had to deal with all that. And I could just see it dragging her down. But I got to follow my small, quiet voice. Well, move it forward. Through her hard work, she was noticed by some people at the Department of Education and was given a job for her last 2 years with the Department of Education. And has graduated then, and I ran into her at Target a couple of months ago, and she's working for the Board of Education doing what she wants, simply because of that small, quiet voice. And the money, she's taken out a fair amount of loans, but she was also able to make a good amount of money working for the Board of Education in the last 2 years of her school. And went her own way by that voice. And that's the healthy attitude.
I had a little different experience myself. I was, you know, in medical school, and I was not going to be a surgeon. You know, I didn't like the lifestyle and blah, blah, blah. I was not going to do it. And then I walked into the operating room one day, and this voice in my head said, this is what I am going to do for the rest of my life. And, like, it wasn't me that said that thing.
Yeah.
It was, like, somebody else. And, like, it was, there was no turning back from that point.
Yeah.
It was not, you know, my ego that said that.
Yeah.
Like, who said that?
Yeah. Yeah. And you'd rather be an investment banker, but...
Yeah, it was a small, quiet voice, so it just got really loud. At that moment, it just broke through and said, this is it.
Yeah. So that's the shepherd. That's the true Logos. Logos meaning the guiding understanding. Some other words for it. Personally, I think that's God myself. The Latin is pneuma, or pneuma, P-N-E-U-M-A. Means both wind and spirit. And interestingly, I think in anybody's dreams, this small, quiet voice is often symbolized by wind or by a breeze. It's very subtle. Another, you know, kind of a paradox. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines up. From 137 at the bottom. As the ruler of the cosmos, he is everywhere, and at the same time he appears to the individual as personal guardian spirit, just as the shepherd, fencing master, and perpetuous visions concerns himself with her. So like we saw, and this, I don't know if this puzzles you or not, but we saw Isis was a collective figure with a personal manifestation in Lucius. Here, the spirit is a world phenomenon with personal manifestations in the individual. And I think this world, this spirit, is behind the events of history. That we are not determined by material factors only, or by national factors, or by oil. That there's something else moving history, and those what look like causes are actually shaped by another deeper process, and that authentic living, listening to that spirit, puts us in touch and helps us find our place within that historical process. The identity, personal identity, and historical place are the same. Eric Erickson defined identity as a process within the individual and a process within the society, and the identity of those two. So that there's a personal spirit and there's a collective spirit in Jung's understanding, which we can see in dreams. I think very often, you know, that these erotic messes that we've talked about, or the woman's struggle with the animus, is to put the individual in their proper place in the process of history. Now, critique. In one of her visions, she has to fight a giant Egyptian, which would be the spirit of heathendom, or what we talked about before, hedonism. And she is turned in to a man as she is being rubbed by youth. A Miles Christi is a soldier of Christ. And then she conquers the enemy. So these visions gave her the courage to face her death. Von Braun talks about Clement of Alexandria, one of the church fathers, being inspired by the very thing we're talking about. But Von Braun says the problem is that she's transformed into a man. Just like Lucius, or not just like, but somewhat like Lucius, having a negative experience turn positive with her, this masculinization on the one hand is a violation of her feminine nature, but on the other hand it gives her the strength to deal with what she has to deal with. And I think what is to learn here is how historical and cultural events put a demand on us towards a certain type of development. Today, this would be a horrible thing for a woman to have to do. At the time, because the spirit was so undeveloped, her path of salvation was actually going against her own nature. That's just the way it is. But since the tenor of the times was overcoming the body, you know, we have to go back to the body. The parallel for the men would be the castrated priests, and for her it would be this becoming a man. So that she's living out the shift of consciousness that was required at the time. But we have just the opposite challenge. We've got to go back to our body, and we've got to recover the feminine. But these things are different in different periods of history. Well, I think that's pretty much that. 139, you okay with that so far? She just, I think, says what I was trying to say, anyway. For her, the transformation was into the spiritual, where for Lucius, it was into feeling through through the body. And again, why are we dealing with this in the book on rejection? Because we meet these experiences first in rejection. We meet these sides of ourselves first in other people. A nice phrase, the secret wire pullers of our destiny. 139, go up 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines up. Then, having sort of now introduced us to the anima and animus, she turns to talking about how they interact at the bottom of 139. And I didn't think that diagram was very clear, so let me put something up here on 140. This would be a man, and this would be his anima. This would be a woman, and this would be her animus. And in any human relationship, there is a relationship between the two egos, between the two contrasexual figures. This is what fighting is. Between the woman and the man's anima, and the man and the woman's animus. So you've got the relationship between two people is actually a relationship between four people six ways. Rather complicated. In alchemy, this is depicted as a union of a king and queen. That's what she's referring to.
Just the whole
16. Yeah, and I don't know those of you who've done psychology of the transference. The king and the queen start out holding flowers. His one hand's down here, her one hand's up here, and they hold this flower. And then the opposite way, her hand's down here, and she holds a flower up here. So that this is depicted in the very beginning of some of these alchemical pictures as the king and the queen holding two things between them that are crossed.
Like the spirit, the dove coming between them.
And the dove coming between them, yeah. Right. Right, so the spirit comes down. And that's what any... I will say deep relationship, which then now, by that I mean in people who have enough psychological knowledge to realize they do have an anima and they do have an animus, and that these factors are playing a relationship, are playing a role in the relationship. That's what you have to take account of.
That's what?
That's what you have to take account of. So her animus says, pick up your socks, and his animus says, go to hell. And they're off and running. hopefully what one tries to do then is, in working on what we've just been talking about, it ceases being an argument. And that the two, anima and anime, can fall in love.
And they can help develop each other.
And they can help develop each other. And I don't think, see what Kathy pointed out, where we're going to in this next chapter is that what comes out of this is the self. The spirit comes down and out of it comes the self. That in order to have a mature relationship, each person has to realize there's a reality bigger than both of them going on. And that they, to have a relationship that lasts, they've got to be aware of the self and the other person. That person has a path of development, which may be not what they want. You know, they thought they were, the guy thought he was marrying a nice homekeeper, and he ends up with somebody whose destiny is to work in industry, or vice versa. He thinks he's marrying a professional woman, and she ends up wanting to just have kids. And if you realize the sacrifices you had to make to realize your own destiny, it's easier to then help the other person realize their destiny, even if it's a sacrifice for you. But that means awareness of the anima and animus. That's why Jung was a little suspicious of relationship therapy, because he felt that relationship is only possible in a situation where people know who they are. And that's where it has to start.
Well, and because if you put the needs of the relationship above the needs of self, because sometimes the self is pulling you apart because you're strangling one another.
Absolutely.
Not because you're helping one another.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And see, if you haven't worked through your anima and animus, you'll project that negative on the other person and say, you know, if you're seeking for independence, well, you're just being whatever, X, Y, or Z. You know, you're just being difficult. You're just being cold. Or,
but can the opposite happen where you are projecting the good onto them and then you feel like you can't leave them even though they're killing you? That would be the situation where you keep falling in love with somebody who beats you up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Any permutation is possible. But I think it's a helpful tool. And it's where what we've been talking about as an individual process also can be applied to relationships. And another place where it applies is in death. I don't think we need to go through that dream. Did everyone follow that dream? I've told you some of this. Told this to some of you. I saw this in a dream of a guy once who was contemplating suicide, and he dreamt that he went to his funeral, and he saw himself there dead, and then he thought, "How could I be at my funeral if I'm dead?" And he realized that at death, consciousness isn't extinguished, and that what, and then he realized he was miserable. So he was dead, looking at himself, and he was miserable. And he thought, oh my God, what's happened is I've transformed into my anima. So at death, I've transformed into my anima, and the state of consciousness of my anima is the state I'm going to be feeling in eternity. He woke up and didn't commit suicide. But that's the same idea. I don't know whether that's literally true or not. But here again, you've got this idea that death is meeting the contrasexual side. And it is surprising how often, I can't say I've seen it that often, but I've seen it. Death is depicted as a marriage. And so what you're doing, you're marrying your contrasexual side at death. That's how the unconscious seems to depict it.
And also I've heard that women see marriage as a death to who they are, and an opening up to who they will become. But at the moment, you know, it's sort of like when you're transforming your ego,
all that
sees it as a death.
It's
just an opening up.
And yeah, it does. I'm just wondering if men see it the same way.
I wonder. Well, it's interesting though, because my my former late husband had a near-death experience when he had his first heart attack. And he came back, he would not speak of what exactly his experience was, but he said, "I'm no longer afraid of death." And I think it had to do something with his animus.
Yeah. That's my working model at the moment. I don't have any other experiences to go by, but it certainly does give some credence to the Christian understanding of death, but also critiques it. It's really not how good you are, whether you're going to get to heaven or not, but the way you live does have something to do with the way you spend eternity. So we can't just get out of this mess. You know, we've got to go through it to the end to fulfill the meaning of the anima or animus for life on earth and also for our own well-being. That dream of his helped me understand something. So, yeah?
I have a feeling that if I don't do it here, I'm going to be sent back.
Or that, yeah.
All over
again. Probably as a grasshopper or something. Yeah. I don't know in that dream whether it wasn't clear whether that soul that he had become would come back again or not. But whatever it was, he said, it's going to be a long time. And I must, the amount of time, in the dream, the amount of time he was going to spend in the state of his unhappy anima was felt to be a long time.
It also gives credence to the whole point of, you know, people who, I find it amazing that the people who are most religious and most believe in heaven are the ones that fight death the most.
You see that, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
It has been my experience of that's true. The ones that will stay the most.
I love the phrase, a spark of the eternal fire hisses out in a puddle. Second to last paragraph. Why bother with all of this stuff we've been talking about? Because I think something of an enjoyment of life and an intensity of living is the result inside ourselves. And there are two types of people, those who have it and those who don't. And the way you keep it is by being true to this process. So that life is always another fascination that is there to teach us something. And if we can be true to that and be true to our values, we are constantly redirected and reconstituted. You know, for me, getting older, one of the horrible things is watching my friends stay stuck. They're still telling the same jokes they were 20 years ago. And their marriages are boring, they're boring, but one meets in this field people who are on a journey, and what you get out of it is an interesting life. So keeping that spark alive is the challenge. And then, we're almost done. She gave us two comparisons in this chapter, which I think are helpful. One, the comparison between the anima and animus. One, entanglement. One, aloof. Remembering to take that with a grain of salt. On the other hand, at the bottom 141, she compares now what it's like working on shadow projections versus what it's like working on animus projections. So, she says, if we compare the projections that issue from the shadow complex with those proceeding from the anima and animus complex, we may say that insight into one's own shadow projections means, first of all, a moral humiliation. Get that straight. intensive suffering, insight into projections originating in the anima or the animus, on the other hand, demand not so much humility as level-headedness in common sense, self-observation, and reflection, which demand a certain wisdom and humanness, because these figures always want to seduce us away from reality into rapture or pull us down into an inner world of fantasy. Who cannot surrender to this experience has never lived. Whoever founders in it has understood nothing. So you have to be able to go with the experience with consciousness. And then come back. Just that last paragraph is worth the whole price of the book.
Mm-hmm. Even just that last sentence?
Yeah. Even that last sentence. Well, folks, we're moving along. I think next time, let's just read the Inner Companion. If we get done early, we'll just chit-chat. But it's about 15, well, what is it? 16 pages today, what did we get through?
Same?
Yeah, about the same. So, we'll probably get done before the end of the semester.
So we're doing it?
Well, I have a proposal. I want to work on Arnold Toynbee and you.
Ah, you mentioned that.
Then, we've had requests for Burkhoizer's work. I don't know how, Toynbee won't be that hard. I'll tell you about it. But what I'd like to do is look at his the relationship of our dreams to history and to the state of our civilization. Then look at Burkhoizer as an example of, they weren't dreams necessarily, but his art as a reflection of working on our civilization's problems and his personal problems as well. So that's my thought.
How many years will we spend on?
Well, probably yeah, about a year.
About a year, okay.
Yeah.
I bet for it.
Okay. Well, see how we feel.
Yeah.
But we'll go through chapters 7, and I think we've got, what, 50 pages left, 55 pages left, so we're doing about 10 or 15 pages a meeting, to give you an idea.
What book would we be using for 20 days?
I'm going to put together my own abridgment.
Okay.